Innovate or regulate? That is the AI question. I'm Leanna Byrne, and thanks for tuning in to the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. A very good morning to you. First of all, Google has announced lots of new artificial intelligence enhancements to its search engine and other apps because it's taking on Microsoft's ChatGPT. And meanwhile, legislators in the European Union are meeting today to help progress the European Union AI Act. Mark Brackell, I was talking to him. He's a policy director at the Future of Life Institute, a non-governmental organisation that advises the EU. He told me that actually competition isn't necessarily a good thing as far as AI is concerned.
The people that we speak to within the companies themselves say, if only we could slow down, if only we could take a breath and think about the consequences that our systems have before we put them out to market, that would be great. But they feel the competitive pressure within OpenAI, they feel it from Google and vice versa. That is why I think we need government regulation. And we need to think of this more as we did with nuclear or with genetic manipulation of humans and human cloning, really transformative technologies where governments have shown that they're able to regulate and able to step in when ethical lines are crossed.
Well, you spoke about regulation there, but if I'm just a normal user of AI, just use ChatGPT sometimes, what are the areas of regulation that are the most important to get right?
So OpenAI took a number of safety measures before they put their system out. Like the raw system, without them taking any measures, allowed you to ask it, how can it kill as many people as possible for a dollar? Or how can it quickly manufacture a chemical weapon using what I have in my local stores? So those kind of questions are now blocked. We're wanting to make sure that this risk mitigation happens systematically, that the companies are required to draw up that documentation, and that regulators can look at that and say that's sufficient or that's not sufficient. Currently, it's great that OpenAI has done this, but we can't, I think, rely on the companies to keep doing this themselves out of their own free will, especially as this competition heats up.
A lot of the time you have issues with digital regulation, don't you? Because, for example, the EU has different data protection rules than the US does. Do you think it's important for countries to adopt homogenous AI regulations?
Definitely. I think what we've seen, I used to work for the Dutch government before I joined the Future of Life Institute several years ago. And that was at the time when the EU introduced its data protection law. And we, as government officials, looked at all the data we had about citizens and deleted a lot of that data. So you saw the immediate impact. And the United States, unfortunately, doesn't have that kind of data privacy legislation. And I think it would be really great if we could make sure that Americans and Chinese and sort of citizens everywhere can benefit from these protections, not just Europeans.
But you advise the EU on the AI Act. Do you think now AI like ChatGPT has been released and it's available to everyone, it needs to be looked at again?
Not necessarily. I think the Act is quite savvy in how it looks at AI. It just says an AI system is machine based and it takes decisions, makes predictions, gives recommendations, or it generates content. So that's a quite neutral definition that doesn't really depend on ChatGPT or the latest technology. And the Parliament has actually done quite a lot to make sure that ChatGPT-like systems really are in scope. And that, for example, OpenAI, which is the company behind ChatGPT, needs to set up a risk management system. They need to identify what risks their system poses to human health, to society, to sort of the truths that, the potential of generating misinformation, so that regulators can look at that and say, well, that's acceptable. You've taken sufficient mitigating measures, or you have not. And that means that governments will have a much stronger grip on these AI systems than they have had until now.
Well, Mark Brackell, Director of Policy for the Future of Life Institute, thank you so much for joining us on Marketplace.
Thank you.
Now, I think it's time to do the numbers. Japan's SoftBank Group reported an annual net loss of $7 billion and Apple supplier Foxconn reported a 56% plunge in its first quarter net profit to $417 billion, its biggest quarterly fall in 3 years. Let's round up some other headlines for you on Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. Following on from the Fed, another central bank, this time the Bank of England, is expected to put up interest rates later today. The French banking giant BNP Paribas says it won't provide further financing to develop new oil and gas fields. It wants to reduce spending in that area by 80% by the end of the decade. And on the flip side, the boss of Ferrari says his company will continue to manufacture cars with a combustion engine alongside hybrid and electric vehicles after the EU watered down a possible ban on combustion engines. Let's go to Egypt now, because it's hosting its first Fashion Week this weekend. In December, the French fashion house Dior held its 2023 fall fashion show at Egypt's ancient Giza pyramids. Now Cairo is hoping to capitalise on this new global interest and is pushing to become fashion capital of the world. Revenues coming from Egypt's fashion industry is projected to reach $1.6 billion this year, according to Statista. And it's projected that's going to grow by 16% year on year, which means the time is right for Egypt to start its own Fashion Week.
The Egyptian fashion industry has really been booming on one side from the creative side. So you have a lot of young emerging designers. I think it has a lot to do with the revolution that happened in 2011, which I think led to a lot of creativity.
That's Susan Sabat, co-founder of the Egyptian Fashion and Design Council. Egypt is a country historically known for its cotton and textiles. When you see Egyptian cotton on your linen, you know it's good stuff. Susan's aim is to get the world thinking of Egyptian fashion with that same stamp of quality.
We are aiming to, again, highlight this industry.
More than 70 Egyptian designers will showcase their collections. One of them is Bulga, a leather footwear brand based in Cairo, founded by Gigi Ibrahim and Mona Sosur. Gigi says their business has been boosted by this recent push to shop local.
There's definitely more of a movement, like you want to call it, like an Egyptian revolution fashion movement, where people are being more conscientious about what they buy and that it's local, that it empowers local communities or works in sustainability, whether culturally or socially or economically.
That's not to say their customers are only Egyptian. Co-founder Mona says they've been surprised by their global appeal.
We're selling for many, many different nationalities, different people, different styles, different ages. I sold for Mexico, for India, and Japanese, European, Americans. So it's like, oh, so we have like really huge potential for different, for global market in different places.
Gigi says an Egyptian Fashion Week will help them to sell even more to international buyers.
We had the Dior fashion show happening in the pyramid, the eyes on Egypt. This will give a huge push, especially coming after Corona, where a lot of those international fairs and fashion shows were smaller.
So if Egypt impresses the global fashion industry this weekend, we might all be walking and dressing like an Egyptian pretty soon. Walk like an Egyptian. And finally, Starbucks is opening its first cafe in central Rome. The Seattle coffee giant is already in Italy. Remember, it launched that line of olive oil-infused drinks. Haven't tried them myself. But Rome has long been considered off-limits because it's just got that rep of being the place to get coffee. Well, obviously, Starbucks is over that. And that's it from the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and thanks for listening.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.